ladies and gentlemen. A very warm welcome to the Parliamentary Library for today's Parliamentary Library Lecture. The lectures bring distinguished speakers to the library to present on important topics of interest relevant to senators and members and the work of the Parliament. My name is Jonathan Curtis. I'm the Assistant Secretary of Research Branch here in the library. Given the task we have is to bring distinguished speakers to present on important topics of interest, I think it's fair to say that it doesn't get much more topical or important than the issue of ISIS at the moment. You rarely see a television news broadcast that doesn't have some new thing they've been up to. And I think it's an issue that's not merely marked by the barbarity of their actions, but the sheer complexity of the political environment in which any of the powers are trying to intervene. I'm very pleased to welcome today's speaker, Professor Amin Saikal, who I think is particularly well-suited to shed some light onto this. Professor Saikal is the University Distinguished Professor of Political Science, Public Policy Fellow and Director of the Centre for Arab and Islamic Studies, Middle East and Central Asia at the Australian National University. He has a long and very distinguished CV, which I won't attempt to go through today. But the salient points, I think, I'll pick out a Rockefeller Foundation Fellow in International Relations, Visiting Fellow at Princeton University, Cambridge University, Indiana University, a member of the Order of Australia, an elected Fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia. He has a long publications list, but latest books include the forthcoming, I gather, Iran at the Crossroads, A New Direction, as well as Zone of Crisis, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran and Iraq in 2014. He's published in major journals and dailies, including the New York Times and The Guardian. Without further ado, I'll ask you to join me in welcoming Professor Saikal. As is usual, he'll speak for around 20 to 30 minutes, and then we'll have a question and answer session at the end of that. Professor Saikal.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, for that very generous introduction. And good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very pleased to be here, and I'm delighted to have this opportunity to discuss the topic of Islamic State and a zone of conflicts within conflicts. The Middle East, its Gulf component in particular, is in the grip of multiple ideological, geopolitical, and humanitarian crises. The region is going through major balance of power shifts, perhaps not seen since the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire and the British and French colonial orchestrations of the region nearly a century ago. The old constellation of forces in support of maintaining the status quo, especially following the Iranian Revolution more than 36 years ago, is altering. A set of new alignments and realignments along multiple overlapping and contested regional and international fault lines, including sectarian divisions and geopolitical rivalries at different levels, has generated favorable conditions for the rise of violent extremist groups such as the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant, or ISIL, or is commonly known as IS, and also some people referring to it as Daesh. The region is redefined in ways that have affected its traditional political and territorial contours. Russia's latest expansion of its military intervention in Syria, with the backing from Iran, Iraq, and the Lebanese Hezbollah, has introduced a further unsettling dimension to the regional crisis. Unless there is an interlocking regional and international consensus to resolve some of the fundamental problems that have made the Middle East so volatile, extremist political Islamism and geopolitical tensions and conflict are set to feature the regional landscape for the for the foreseeable future. The sudden rise of the extremist Sunni ISIL, its conquest of vast swathes of Iraqi and Syrian territories, and its declaration in June last year of Khilafat, or borderless Islamic State, under the leadership of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, as Khalifa, or deputy to the Prophet of Islam, and Amir al-Mu'mineen, or the commander of the faithful, have fatally fractured an already politically and territorially fragmented Iraq and Syria. Islamic State's Wahhabi Salafist rooted interpretation and application of Islam within an extremist narrative with utopian goals and its declaration of violent jihad against all those who oppose or disagree with its stance have caused a tsunami of reaction from within and outside of the multifaceted Muslim world. Islamic State is disowned by a great majority of Muslims and rejected as a qualified Islamic entity by most Islamic authorities. Al-Baghdadi and his cohorts, including many experienced but aggrieved Ba'athist supporters of Saddam Hussein era, have nonetheless been able to skillfully manipulate a number of variables to justify and enforce their Khilafat, as temporary or durable as it may turn out to be, and to make it a jihad against what Islamic State has called crusaders and usurpers, actionable within a favorably resourceful geographical zone. Those variables that Islamic State has manipulated consist of the war-torn conditions and presence of power vacuum in Syria and Iraq, the symbolism of Khilafat and other historical Islamic signs, the disenchantment of the Sunni segments of the Syrian and Iraqi populations, the Saudi-Iranian geopolitically driven Sunni-Shia sectarian rivalry, the socio-economic disparities and injustices, and the prevalence of largely Western-backed authoritarian and corrupt regimes across the Middle East. Highlighting the list are also Israel's repressive colonial settler occupation of the Palestinian lands, including the third holiest site of Islam, that is East Jerusalem, and a general sense of disempowerment and humiliation amongst Muslims in the face of repeated major power, most importantly U.S., interventions to shape and reshape the Middle East and the wider Muslim world according to their ideological and geopolitical preferences. All this has helped al-Baghdadi's leadership to consolidate Islamic State, to entice some Muslims to fall for Islamic State's extremist narrative, and to support its institution of Khilafat, a phenomenon that has had precedence in Islamic history and nostalgically resonates with many Muslims since its abolition in 1924. Notwithstanding its violent and repressive theocratic nature, Islamic State now functions as a relatively consolidated political and territorial entity. It has developed an identifiable system of governance under the command of a governing council presented over by al-Baghdadi, although it's not known how often and in what manner the council meets. Whilst the office of Khalifa stands supreme in its edicts or absolute, a chain of intertwined civilian and security command features in its operations. Islamic State has mastered sufficient resource capability to be able to combat, defend, and expand its territory from Ramadi in Iraq to Raqqa in Syria, a territory about the size of France. Moreover, it has harnessed the capacity to provide some basic municipal services to many of the 6 to 8 million people under its control, and to enforce a elaborate process of indoctrination and recruitment. In addition to its $2 billion worth of assets, resulting largely from its initial conquest, Islamic State has boosted its revenue sources through a number of other coercive and illegal measures. They include taxes and cross-border trade through both Turkey and Lebanon, involving selling not only of oil from the fields under its control, but also the peddling of invaluable relics and artifacts from the historical sites that it has destroyed and vandalized in both Iraq and Syria. It has even put one Roman coin up on eBay for $100. The more Islamic State is become shaped as a quasi-state, the more it has become vulgar and strident. Of those who have opted to actively participate in Islamic State's declared jihad, most are from within the zone of the conflicts in the Arab world, but a good number have also come from across the globe. Some have joined Islamic State out of deep religious conviction. Others include many fringe and misguided elements from Muslim communities who have had no more than a mundane understanding of Islam, have suffered from a void of or purpose in life, and are grieved by a sense of disposition and alienation for different reasons and are therefore vulnerable to Islamic State's slick social media propaganda. Islamic State's male foreign fighters are now estimated to number around 30,000. Despite its patriarchic, misogynic, discriminatory and brutal treatment of women, particularly those from non-Sunni Muslim minorities, a sizable number of Muslim girls and women have also been lured to Islamic State. They have become participants in its jihad, either in an active or supporting role. Reportedly, there are some 3,000 women from the Arab and Muslim domain, as well as the West, in the service of Islamic State. Most are tasked as morality activists and police and rule enforcers, with some also wearing the mantle of jihadi brides. They include a number of Malaysians and Indonesians. There are also non-Muslim, especially Yazidi, women who have been coerced to serve as comfort providers and slaves. In this context, Islamic State has evidently pursued an integrative strategy of action on three fronts. First, it is drawn on an extremist version of Islam to invent an ideological narrative that has focused primarily on two objectives. One is to legitimize the application of brutal theocratic measures to enforce its rule. Another is to invoke those causes that could resonate with not only the Sunni segments of the Iraqi and Syrian populations, but also a good number of Sunni Arabs and fellow Muslims around the world. When it comes to the use of politics of brutality, Islamic State is not too far ahead of some of other extremist groups, such as the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, and Boko Haram, some of whose elements have declared allegiance to the Islamic State. Second, the Islamic State has deployed the concept of Khilafat to endear itself with those Muslims who either naively or nostalgically believe that a return to the unity of all Muslim countries under a single supreme religious and political leader is the answer to the deep-seated problems that have come to beset the Muslim world. Its anti-Shia and anti-Kurdish stance has aimed at fueling sectarian and ethnic divisions within the region and beyond. Whereas some Arab states have taken solace in Islamic State's opposition to Shia Islam and therefore to Iran and its allies, Islamic State's anti-Kurdish posture has led Turkey to view it as a deterrent to the Iraqi Kurds' aspirations for an independent state that could have overflow effects on the large Turkish Kurdish minority. Consequently, the Arab countries and Turkey have had reasons to be somewhat lenient towards Islamic State, as long as the entity is contained and does not pose a real threat to them. Third, Islamic State's opposition to the US-led West and Israel as the quote-unquote exploiters and occupiers, allegedly causing Muslims humiliation and disempowerment through either direct or indirect means, has had its own twisted logic. It has focused on persuading all those Muslims that have grievances more specifically against the United States and its allies for various reasons, some personal and others political and social in nature, either to view and in some cases support the new Khilafat as a force of salvation. As such, Islamic State has generated three concentric ideological, political, and military circles of operation at the national, regional, and international levels within a religious narrative that enables it to exploit the weaknesses and loopholes at each of those levels. In the age of digital communications, it has managed to secure effective recruiters to disseminate its propaganda widely to those who are vulnerable to its messages. No wonder so many young Muslim men and women have fallen prey to Islamic State's propaganda. In contrast, the United States and its allies have not been able to come up with an effective counter-narrative and a military campaign which would be part of a comprehensive political strategy to deal with those Islamic State's causes that defy military solution. Their emphasis on the primacy of the use of brute force, mostly through an air campaign, and on de-radicalization and harsher anti-terrorism measures at home and abroad have fallen terribly short of countering Islamic State's strategy. Western governments' desire to extract political mileage for domestic purposes and listen to those instant experts on combating terrorism and radicalization who lack a clear understanding of the complexities of what Islamic State in its arena of operations are all about, have left them bare vis-a-vis an entity that has surprisingly managed to be one step ahead of them. Intensified bombardments of Islamic State's position and provision of substantial aid to the Iraqi forces and Kurdish subnational militia of Peshmerga to do the ground fighting have so far produced no tangible result. The United States has lately found it necessary to ditch an important plank of its policy of combating Islamic State, that is raising a sizable fighting force from the ranks of the moderate Syrian opposition. Apart from the lack of a coherent and viable strategy, it is important to mention three other factors that have impeded the US-led efforts to the delight of Islamic State and the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad and its supporters. The first factor relates to the fact that the US-led Western-backed Iraqi government has proved to be persistently incompetent, corrupt, and dysfunctional. Whereas Prime Minister Nur al-Maliki catered primarily to his base of power among Iraqi Shia majority and in close cooperation with Tehran at the cost of marginalizing the Iraqi Sunnis, his successor, Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, who took the reins of power in July last year, following Islamic State's routing of what was the best American-trained and equipped Iraqi military, has not done much better. Al-Abadi comes from the same Shia group called Dawah as al-Maliki. He cannot afford to make more than cosmetic concessions to the Iraqi Sunnis, given his concerns about not antagonizing his Shia compatriots and Tehran. Also, like al-Maliki, he has been unable to prevent Iraq's other substantial minority, that is the Kurds, from consolidating an extensively autonomous state of their own in northern Iraq. The position of this state is reinforced by the US and its allies providing military assistance to Peshmerga as an anti-Islamic state force, despite its repercussions for Iraq's national unity. The second factor was the inability or unwillingness of the United States and its allies to intervene in Syria early enough to accelerate the fall of Assad's regime, which has committed as much, if not more, brutalities as Islamic States against the Syrian people. President Obama's 2013 backdown from intervening even when the regime had crossed the red line by using chemical weapons and return for a Russian proposal to get rid of Syria's weapons of mass destruction was a survival victory for Assad and a diplomatic and a strategic triumph for Russia, as well as for Iran and Lebanese Hezbollah. The third is the resilience of the Assad regime and its shrunken military and security forces to stay in the fight, although with important support from its external supporters, and to maintain its non-negotiating position vis-à-vis the Western and Arab-backed moderate opposition forces. Assad's staying power has ultimately prompted the United States and its allies to make an about-face and drop their demand for Assad's removal as part of a solution to the Syrian crisis. They have lately offered to negotiate with Assad for a transitional phase. It is important to note that the popular uprisings of Syria's Sunni majority against Assad's Alawite minority-dominated rule in the wake of the so-called Arab Spring nearly 5 years ago were all very peaceful. Assad had ample opportunity to reach a negotiated settlement with the opposition. However, he chose to crush it by force. He did so in the tradition of authoritarian political culture that has historically dominated the Muslim Middle East, and also in the context of the counter-Arab Springs efforts launched by the Arab conservative forces led by Saudi Arabia and acquiesced to by the United States and many of its allies. This was exemplified vividly in the case of Egypt. It's not surprising that the calculated and unpredictable Russian President Vladimir Putin has recently found a unique opportunity to make a daring show of force in a direct military intervention in support of the Assad regime against not just Islamic State, but all opposition forces, including those backed by the West and the Arab world. For Putin, it's not only the issue of saving the regime that could enable Russia to maintain and expand a strategic foothold in a vital region of the world. It is also about reasserting Russia's position and strengthening its bargaining power on the world stage. Predictably, the Russian intervention, whilst emboldening the Assad regime and its supporters, can only alarm the United States and its Western allies and Arab partners, as well as Turkey, which has had historical differences with Russia. They have condemned the Russian intervention as dangerously one-sided, fueling and widening rather than solving the Syrian conflict and assisting Islamic State. The Russian intervention is indeed risky. This is the first time that Russia has engaged in a direct military action outside the perimeters of the former Soviet Union. It carries the potential not only for accidental crashes in the air with the US and allied planes, but also for landing Moscow in a very costly quagmire, similar to that confronted by the Soviet Union in Afghanistan following its invasion of the country 3.5 decades ago. The Syrian intervention is admittedly not on the same scale as the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and Putin has vowed to confine Russia's involvement to air operations. It has nonetheless been launched for the purpose of primarily saving an allied regime and projecting Russia's power. This also underpinned the Soviet motives in relation to its Afghan adventure. Yet the Soviet invasion offered the United States and its allies a unique opportunity to inflict a fatal blow to the Soviet Union by assisting their Afghan proxy forces, the Mujahideen or Islamic Freedom Fighters. The defeat of the Soviet Union after a decade of fighting in Afghanistan substantially contributed to the country's disintegration in late 1991. The same scenario could be repeated in Syria, should the United States and its allies decide to act in the way that they did in Afghanistan. In the medium to long run, Russia's weakening economy, caused partly by Western sanctions over Moscow's annexation of Crimea, its meddling in eastern Ukraine, the decline of income from its oil exports due to a spectacular drop in oil prices, and its second-rate military may not be able to cope with such a development, a factor that also affected the Soviet-Afghan adventure. The Russian intervention has certainly bolstered Assad's position and that of its other main backer, the Islamic Republic of Iran. However, the apparent Moscow-Tehran-Baghdad-Damascus-Hezbollah axis draws a formidable line between what may be regarded as the northern and southern Middle East now. This can potentially complicate further Iran's regional position and its process of the possible normalization of ties with the West. It can invite a united Sunni Arab Turkish front, with the US not only backing this front, but also becoming more incremental in its approach to the implementation of the historic nuclear agreement between Iran and the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council plus Germany, which was signed on 14th of July this year. As the situation stands, there are now two international coalitions, one led by the United States and another by Russia, against a common enemy, that is the Islamic State, but concurrently in competition with one another by supporting opposite sides in at least the Syrian conflict. This can only augur well for Islamic State survivability and provide a recipe for a perfect Middle Eastern storm with serious regional and global implications. An interlocking regional and international consensus is now needed amongst the key players, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Turkey, as well as the United States and Russia, to deal collectively not only with the Islamic State, but also with a host of issues that have aided the Islamic States and fragmented Iraq and Syria. If accompanied by such national reforms that could lift the blanket of authoritarianism or concealed authoritarianism from the region, along with a American-Iranian rapprochement, one could hope for a more stable and less volatile Middle East in the medium to long run. Otherwise, for the time being, while there is no effective counter-strategy to roll IS back, the Islamic State has a strategy to survive. Thank you very much.
Any questions? I have, while people are thinking, I have one to kick off. You mentioned a few of the few players, the key regional players, the Saudis, the Iranians and the Turks. What would, let's take Turkey, what would Turkey's end game look like? What would success look like for Turkey, and what does that say about their agenda?
Well, I think the Russian intervention has now confronted Turkey with a real quandary. On the one hand, Turkey is very much interested in seeing Islamic State being contained, if not rolled back altogether, because after all, it is an anti-Kurdish entity. And that's also partly explains why Turkey has been somewhat quite lenient towards Islamic State. On the other hand, also Turkey would not be in favor of seeing Russia as a major power in its backyard, because Turkey has had serious security concerns from Russia over a long period of time. And in the relationship, while they've had a good and neighborly working relationship, but not been really all that cordial. And they've been, both sides have been very suspicious of one another. In the meantime, I think Turkey wants to also kill two birds with one stone, and that is not only to contain the Islamic State, but also to really weaken the position of the Kurdish Workers' Party, that's PKK, or its power base, in both northern Syria as well as in Iraq. And the PKK, of course, wants to basically create, or has been fighting for the last 40 years for the creation of an extensively autonomous Kurdish state out within Turkey. And of course, the Kurds in Turkey form something like 18% of the total population, something like 65 million. It's a fairly substantial, it's a substantial minority. So I think the situation has become more and more complex for Turkey. And in the meantime, this opposition to the Kurds has resulted in more violence in Turkey, which is again confronted the President Erdogan's government with serious problems. So I think that at this stage, the end games for Turkey looks very muddy and very messy, and we really don't know what is going to be the next move on the part of the Turkish leadership to deal with the Kurds on one side with the IS in terms of at least containing it on the other side, and at the same time really trying to somehow make sure that this Russian involvement in Syria does not jeopardize Turkey's security, or for that matter, allow Russia to have a much stronger foothold in the Middle East and reviving the old Cold War in some ways.
And would effectively allow Russia to circle to some extent, yeah. If I can have a follow-up question, to what extent do you think that a solution, a solution in that region, is likely to reflect the post-World War I boundaries of those sort of states, or are they becoming increasingly irrelevant?
Well, I think those boundaries have already changed with the emergence of Islamic State, because the border between Iraq and Syria has been wiped out altogether. So we already, began to witness the possibility of wider changes in the geographical contours of the region. But in addition to that, we know that also Yemen is in total fragmentation,
yeah.
And so is Libya. I mean, both of those countries. And I think in the medium to long run, and not to talk about the immediate terms, mm-hmm. it's going to be extremely difficult to put these states back together to their pre-conflict status. Mm-hmm. It's going to be very, very difficult. So I think, as I pointed out towards the end of my talk, that the three major players in the region, and also the five permanent members of the Security Council, get together in order to reach an interlocking regional and international consensus on the Middle East, just not on Syrian conflict and Iraqi conflict, but also on a number of other conflicts. I think we are really beginning to witness the important power shifts in the region, and also possibly change of the geographical contours.
Questions? Sir?
Thank you for a very interesting speech. My question relates to your comparison to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And using that historical example, Afghanistan was in the direct sort of backyard of the Soviet Union, but now Syria is arguably a bit further away from Russia. What would you say are the main interests Russia has in the region?
Well, I think, Putin has decided that Russia is going to have a more reassertive role in world politics. And this is not the first time that he has made a daring show of force. Of course, we know that he's dismembered Georgia by taking over Abkhazia a few years ago. And we know that he's moved into eastern Ukraine and already annexed Crimea. I think Putin would like to really send a very clear message to the United States and its allies that it is now emerging as a world power and would like to really play that role in world power and should be respected as such. And of course, this was also the struggle in which the former Soviet Union was locked. That the Soviet Union also always wanted to be treated as an equal by the United States and therefore be an equal participant in all the goods that happen, good things that happen in the world, and also in the resolution of all the problems that happens in the world. And I think that's what Putin has decided to do. And I think his move into Syria is primarily to not only maintain an important strategic ally, but also to have an important foothold in a very vital region of the world. Of course, that is very alarming to the Arabs and to the United States and its allies, and also, of course, to Israel. And that's why Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made a very quick trip to Moscow in order to get assurances from Vladimir Putin that his intervention in Syria is not going to jeopardize Israel's security. But of course, we will see how that is going to evolve, because the Russian intervention has taken place with the support of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and of course Hezbollah, and the direct participation of them in the operations. And as we also know, that Prime Minister Netanyahu has very much promoted what I would call Iranophobic approach to his foreign policy, in a sense that he's been very, very hostile to the Islamic Republic of Iran, and at the same time he's rejected the nuclear agreement which was signed between, which has been signed between Iran and the world powers, and for that he's also been very, very critical of the United States. So with the Iranians and Hezbollahs and the Russians all together being in Syria, that does not really augur well as far as Prime Minister Netanyahu's concerns about Israel's security are concerned.
Let's go to you and then next one along. So,
on the same topic, there appears to be an intifada, a new intifada starting in Israel. I'm just curious on your views on that and its relationship to what's happening in Iraq and Syria.
Well, I think you're right. We are on the verge of a third intifada. And of course, at the roots of all the problems, the whole Israeli-Palestinian conflict really lies Israel's occupation of the Palestinian lands. I mean, as long as that really continues, even if this, the beginning of this intifada is somewhat suppressed, there's always going to be another wave. I wouldn't really see it altogether divorced from what's really happening in the region as a whole. We know that this intifada, or the beginning of this intifada, if it is going to develop into a third intifada, had its roots in Israeli arsonists, as they call them, arsonists. But of course, they were in many ways, if you would like to really term the overload, use the overloaded terms, the terrorists. I mean, it was a terrorist action of burning the house and killing two members of the family, including a child, in abandoning my life. I mean, and then, of course, the provocative actions on the part of the Israelis to open up Al-Aqsa Mosque, you know, to Jewish worshippers, and to also limit the access to Al-Aqsa Mosque by the Palestinians. That really sparked off the whole thing. We know, but then, I guess, the root of the whole thing is the Israeli occupation. As long as this occupation lasts, I doubt it very seriously that either Israelis or, for that matter, the Palestinians could really live in peace. The important thing is that the Israelis will have to really see that their independence, their freedom, and their prosperity and their security are very much intertwined with the freedom, prosperity, and security of the Palestinians. And they have not really come to that realization yet. But in the meantime, the world opinion is really shifting in support of the Palestinian cause. And we know that. And I think Israel is becoming more and more isolated. As you may have noticed, that in the hoisting of the flag of Palestine just a few days ago at the United Nations, it was only Israel and a handful of states that boycotted it. And of course, that has also happened with a number of other UN General Assembly's resolutions. So I think Israel is coming under a lot more pressure now than has been the case in the past.
Thank you. My question was just your thoughts on a country like Indonesia that's transitioned to a more of a democratic state. How has that been successful, whereas we haven't really seen that to the same extent in any sort of Middle Eastern country? So I was wondering your thoughts on how Indonesia's been successful to do that, and if it's possible in the Middle East.
I think that's a very interesting question, and of course I'm not a specialist on Indonesia, but we do have very, very able specialists at ANU on Indonesia. But my personal reading of the situation is that Indonesians are converts of Islam. They are not the original recipients of Islam. It's the Arabs, and more specifically, the people from the Arabian Peninsula, who were the original recipients of Islam. And Islam was revealed to an Arab prophet. And Islam was revealed in Arabic language. Islam glorified the Arabs, and Arabs glorified Islam by spreading its message to the four corners of the world. And it, really, Islam was spread to Indonesian archipelago by the Arab traders and by mystics of Islam. These are the two groups who brought it. And Islam, in the case of Indonesia, was grafted into an already existing or a set of existing cultures. And Islam adopted a dialectic process. And this process, it Islamized many aspects of Indonesian cultures and way of life. And also, in turn, it took some of the things from that. So when you see the Indonesian Islam is somewhat very different, for example, from the Saudi Arabian Islam, or for that matter, Egyptian Islam. I mean, it has always been a sort of a moderate Islam in Indonesia. Of course, you've got extremist groups from time to time, whether it's Jamaah Islamiyah or Hizb Tahrir or, you know, whatever, they do emerge. But a great majority of Indonesians, they've embraced a moderate Islam, and that has really allowed them to really open up to the kind of democratic reforms which have taken place. And of course, that in itself is relatively new. It's only over the last 10 years or so. But let's hope that that's going to really become an example for other Muslim countries. But let's not also forget that the Turks have nurtured a similar kind of democracy, but that democracy is coming under increasing pressure at the moment for a number of reasons.
We might have time for, yes, just one more question, Phil.
In Afghanistan, it's over 10 years since the Taliban was overthrown as the government, but even now the Taliban is still active, and I think some pragmatic commentators and actors are saying that they must be part of a political solution in Afghanistan. So, sort of using that analogy in the Middle East, is the elimination of the Islamic State a realistic aim? Could that actually be achieved, particularly given that there are sort of historical precedents for a caliphate existing? And secondly, as unpalatable as that might be to accept an Islamic State, would that be the least worst option?
Thank you for asking that question. I think a simple answer to your question would be that the reason that the United States and its allies have been very willing, particularly since 2009 with the rise of President Obama to power, to negotiate with the Taliban is because that they haven't been able to really totally marginalize or beaten the Taliban. So the Taliban have managed, for a variety of reasons, to stay in the fight. I don't think they are really in a position to take over the government in Afghanistan, but certainly they can. They are in a position to make life very difficult for the Afghans, and of course also tying down the resources of the government to a low-grade insurgency, and therefore preventing the Afghan resources to be invested in the reconstruction of the country, and also for the betterment of the conditions of living for the Afghan people. I think that at this stage, the decision on the part of the United States and its allies is to treat the Islamic State as a terrorist entity, and really fight it on that ground. But I do recall that in the height of the Iraqi crisis, and 2006-2007, when the United States was fighting various Sunni-led insurgency groups, particularly the Islamic State of Iraq, which was headed by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, I published a piece in International Herald Tribune, which was also published in the New York Times, in which I argued that perhaps the time has come to talk to the enemies, rather than really pursue a one-track approach, and that is the use of brute force. And that's not going to work. I do not really claim that that the United States really listened to me, or the American policymakers listened to me. But I do recall that within a very short space of time after that piece came out, and then the United States did stop talking. And to end, John F. Petraeus formed the Sons of Iraq from amongst the Sunnis, and trying to really incorporate the Sunnis into the processes and make the system far more inclusive than it had been, you know, that far. And I think to some extent that really worked. And of course, then the Sons of Iraq were able to fight Al Qaeda. And of course, Al Qaeda had no existence in Iraq prior to the US-led invasion in 2003. But I mean, then the Sons of Iraq proved quite really effective to fight. And of course, Al-Zarqawi himself was killed in an American bombing. When the time might really come for the adversaries of Islamic State to come to the conclusion that yes, perhaps we may need to talk to some of the elements within Islamic State, as far as I can see, that time is not there now. But if the situation evolves in ways which Islamic State survives, and the medium to long run, I think that possibility exists, and a possibility of dialogue between not the core leadership of the Islamic State, but certain elements or influential elements within the Islamic State. But then on the other hand, we also have Hamas. Hamas is designated as a terrorist organization, and yet Hamas is part and parcel of the Palestinian nationalist movement. I mean, so we are willing to talk to the Taliban, but we are not really willing to talk. And of course, we designated Taliban as a terrorist organization for a long time, a terrorist movement. So we are willing to really talk to the Taliban, but we are not really willing to talk to Hamas or recognize Hamas as part of the Palestinian nationalist movement. And we also know at the same time that if Hamas is not part of a solution, it is always in a position to wreck a solution.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we're out of time. As I suspected, having listened to your very interesting discussion and briefing on the situation, it's confirmed my worst fears. It's very, very complicated. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Professor Zeikal. If I can just keep you for a moment more, I'd just like to give a very quick advert, I suppose, for our Parliamentary Library lecture next week, where we will be joined by Professor Miranda Stewart, who's also from the ANU, is the Director of the Tax and Transfer Policy Institute. And she's talking about what is tax reform for and what can it do, which I think is a similarly topical issue given the likely emergence of the tax white paper soon. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Very interesting.
Please give my.
She wanted to burn me.
Thank you very much. Pass on my.
That's scary.
Did you?
That wasn't true.
Sometimes you just have to say it. At least the people are informed how complex it is.
It'll be interesting to see what happens. Well, it's going to be terrible.
Oh, fantastic.
Thank you, Shannon. Thank you for your help. That's okay. No, I'm fine, thanks. I'm really very used to doing these now. It's not the easiest thing, but you get used to it.
Well, you just know what to do.
Yeah.
After a while, is it? Oh yeah, that is how it's spreading. Thank you very much for offering. We appreciate it. People,
yeah, that's right.